Okay. Thank you very much, Tony. Let me tell you a little bit about the talk and what I'm planning to do. This is to some extent a bit of a work in progress, so I apologize if in places it's a little bit rough, but it's an outcome of some discussions that I was having with Bob Connolly over this summer, where we were talking about how to generalize the method that you probably all know of Bob's of generating these catalog of symmetric tensegrities. And that's a rather specialist catalog because you have a particular recipe to generate the structures. And I'm going to talk a little bit later on about how we can generalize that recipe to generate really any of the symmetric tensegrities, although, of course, the results tend not to be so elegant as they are for the kind of simple case, the first case that Bob did. And here's in some respects, my favorite tensegrity structure, because this is an example of a structure that has, under symmetry operations, all the nodes are equivalent to each other, so there's one orbit of nodes. All the struts, the compression members, are equivalent to another, there's one orbit of struts, and there's one orbit of cables, and so all the cables are equivalent to each other. And I think this is the unique example of a three-dimensional tensegrity of this type, where all of the compression members are separated from one another and don't meet anywhere. So this is the only example of a three-dimensional structure of this type with one orbit of nodes, one orbit of cables, and one orbit of struts, which satisfies this common idea of tensegrity that you might want to have compression members entirely separated from one another. Okay, so a little bit of background to those of you who might not be familiar with tensegrity structures. And there's a marvellous book that I've recently bought showing lots of pictures of Kenneth Snelson's tensegrity structures. And he has this nice title called Forces Made Visible. And I quite like that idea of a tensegrity that essentially, because you've got cables, you know where the tension is going to lie in a cable. And the compression members show where the compression lies. So there's no, everything's on show in terms of what the structure looks like. And of course, this is a talk about generating tensegrities, and Kenneth Snelson really was, he's a great master at doing this, so I've got some examples of pictures of tensegrity structures that he's built as sculptures. They're a marvellous set of interesting examples. All of these pictures I've borrowed from his book. Some of them are highly symmetric, such as the famous Needle Tower, but then lots of them really seem to show no symmetry at all. And this is an example that's at on the campus at Stanford. This is a very large structure. Hallmark greeting cards, I think, have commissioned this one. This is a very fine cantilevered structure in Japan. But I have to admit, I have no idea how Snelson is able to generate these structures. So the kind of artistic ability to be able to generate a structure of this type is something I really don't understand. And so certainly I'm not going to talk about today, although I do have an undergraduate student this year who's at least starting to make a study of some of these sculptures to try and see if we can work out the common features in how Snelson does this. So I'm not going to talk about these kind of sculptures because I don't know anything about them. What I'm going to do is look at much simpler symmetric structures where I can generate and show some of the mathematics that enables you to find classes of simple example structures. Now, tensegrity is a subject that suffers because there's a bit of a surplus of definitions about what tensegrity is. And so you'll find things like Buckminster Fuller writing, well, things that really I struggle to really understand what he means at all. And even René Mottro, who's more of an engineer, but I still find it difficult to be... They tend to be rather too vague in my mind. So I'm going to simply use the mathematical definition of tensegrity as being a pin-jointed framework. So you have a set of nodes in space where the members defining the nodes may be of three types. So a cable only carries tension and is hence a... it's an inequality constraint on the length, that a length between points can't get longer. A strut is the opposite, only carries compression, points can't get closer together. And you might have bars as well carrying either tension or compression. And so we might draw a picture that looks like this of a tensegrity that actually would be unstable in three space. But that's... So I have this very simple definition of what we're talking about. And the idealization, if you think of it in purely geometric terms, would be that a cable can get shorter but not longer, a strut can get longer but not shorter, and a bar has got a fixed length. That's a very pure geometrical idea. As a structural engineer, which is my background, I probably think about a structure where I allowed some stiffness of the structure, I might allow some things to move. And of course, in general, mathematicians are probably happy to choose any even more general idealization than this. So my version tends to be this rather simple case where you have some, for a cable, you have some stiffness in tension but not in compression. A strut, you have stiffness in compression or tension, and a bar has got stiffness all through. Right, so a little bit of my background. Tensegrities are interesting to a structural engineer because the terms that many tensegrities, the reason many tensegrities are stiff, they rely on the stiffness terms that we tell our students right at the very start of their course, day one, to throw away the relevant terms. So it's in a sense, as a structural engineer, the more you learn about how structures work, the more mysterious a tensegrity structure will appear. Because we always make an assumption that we're working with first-order kinematics, equilibrium in the undeformed state, and this means that the terms of relevance we just throw away. There are good reasons why we might want to do that, but it does mean that there's sometimes a little work required to get over some of this to talk to engineers like myself. And it's interesting to compare actually where this comes from, and part of it goes back, in fact, to James Clerk Maxwell. And Maxwell was essentially, engineers are interested in infinitesimal rigidity, that they don't want structures that aren't infinitesimally rigid. And that's exactly what Maxwell wrote in 1864, that here's a definition of a framework consisting of points in space where you've got this pure geometric constraint. And Maxwell defined infinitesimal rigidity essentially as saying you need this count of 3j minus 6 bars to render a structure stiff. And when he means stiff, it's clear that he means infinitesimally rigid and not rigid in the more general sense. Many tensegrities, however, of course, we know don't satisfy this condition. But I think I would claim that Maxwell was the first person to understand tensegrity, because he comments in the paper that there are examples of structures, tensegrity structures, that you might say, where you do get stiffness, where you have less bars, members in a structure, than the strict count required for infinitesimal rigidity. But that's associated with maximum or minimum lengths of certain elements of the bars, of certain elements of the members. And that's clearly a description of an internal state of self-stress within the structure. So this is Maxwell here is saying that if you have a tensed framework of the type that we're thinking of with tensegrity structures, where you have cables in tension, struts in compression, then you will get some stiffness to that structure. But he makes then this interesting comment, which is not something I'm going to talk about very much today, but still interesting to mention in passing, that he says the stiffness of the frame is of an inferior order. So he talks about a small disturbing force may produce a displacement infinite in comparison with itself. Now, I was always very concerned about this comment when I read it, because Maxwell typically doesn't make mistakes, in my experience. Things he writes are very carefully thought out. And so that infinite seemed a very strong thing to say. But I'm straying to a different talk. I'm straying to a talk about stiffness of tensegrities. But it turns out that there is a sense in which this is a perfectly valid thing to say in the case of a strictly strong geometric constraint, that there is a division between the stiffness, the first order stiffness, the stiffness that engineers like to deal with, the infinitesimal rigidity, and the other rigidity terms that you get within a tensegrity structure. No, but I might talk to you later. So this is a different talk that I'm straying into. But it was just such an interesting comment that I wanted to say it on the way past. Okay, so let's look at some examples of highly symmetric tensegrities. So I mentioned, when I looked at Snelson's work, that I didn't really understand how he generates those ideas. That's true. What I'm going to do here now is at least understand a set of structures that I do understand how we can generate them and how we can use symmetry to generate them. And of course, here's the classic simple example. I saw some models outside, for instance, it's the simple one that everyone might build, that has a dihedral symmetry, a threefold dihedral symmetry. This is my example that I mentioned earlier, a sort of favourite example. You buy like a baby toy of this type. That's a very nice example of these structures. And then, of course, Bob showed how, with a very simple recipe, you can generate lots of highly symmetric tensegrities, and these are examples that are taken from Bob's catalogue of tensegrities with octahedral or icosahedral symmetries. And there are a finite number of tensegrities that you can generate where you have the recipe that all of these structures use is that you have a single orbit of nodes. That means every node is equivalent to every other node. And it's a single regular orbit of nodes, which means that corresponding to every symmetry operation for the structure, there is a single node. So there are as many nodes as there are symmetry operations. In some sense, the nodes are in a general configuration. All the struts, the compression members, are equivalent to each other. And there are two different types of cables, which are here coloured in grey and in black. So if you have a regular set of nodes, this is the minimum set of members you need to make a rigid structure. If I go back a moment to the example I showed before, this example the nodes are not in general position. They lie on planes of symmetry. And it's that that allows you to consider this as just having this slightly more restricted set of only one orbit of members. Okay. And just in passing, I've got some nice pictures here of a tensegrity that an alumnus of the university wanted to build and came to talk to me about calculating lengths, and I passed him to my student Raj, who'd been working on understanding Bob's models of these things, and he was very happy. This is a very large structure, it's a very nice structure, that the members here, compression members, are 2.5 meters in length, so it's a nice big structure. And so here's Bob visiting last summer, when this structure was first unveiled. And it's an example of one of the things from Bob's catalogue. And that's my student Raj, who's also been working on this. And here's the picture of the tensegrity. And although I'm not talking about stiffness of tensegrities, I have another talk about self-weight deflection. And it actually looks a bit more like that if you don't tense it up enough. So it all gets a bit squashed up at the bottom. So this is the ideal form of the structure if it were not having, if there was no gravity. Take a bit of gravity and support some of the nodes and it squashes itself down a little bit. And how do you get rid of this deformation? One thing you need to do is to tense things up as much as possible. Then you have to be careful that you don't buckle the compression members. So how do you not avoid buckling the compression? There's a lot of interesting questions you could ask on those questions. However, getting back to the talk that I'm giving today, this was the conversation that we were having this summer on symmetric tensegrities in lectures on lost mathematics, which many of you will be familiar with. There are some pictures of interesting tensegrity structures. Now, if you read, so of course I never went to these workshops, I was about 10 at the time, but if you read in the notes about the workshops, the sketches that are described here are sketches of tensegrities that there were models that were being shown, and this was meant to remind you of the model. Well, of course, I didn't have the model in the first place. But we were discussing this summer about these structures that are clearly highly symmetric, but don't fit in with Bob's catalogue. And the reason that is that these are examples where there are different types of nodes. There are different orbits of nodes. There's not just one type of node. And this is a very nice sculpture. So I'm glad everyone's building models. Here's my little model of this structure that I might pass round. It's got very interesting symmetry properties that we'll come to in a moment. And here's another example, which is, which I think I've recreated. It's the, essentially, you can think of it as something like the simple simplex model that we see outside, with replacing the ends with a little T section. So here again is a little model I'll pass around of one of these sculptures. So should be possible to work out the symmetry of the model if you're okay. So let me now describe a little bit about how you might be able to generate tensegrity structures of this type and use these models as inspiration before being able to generate whole catalogues of other models in addition to the ones that we might be familiar with. And I'm going to just work through the the simple example of the Grunbaum tensegrity there as an example of how this works out and how it's different to what people have done what particularly Bob Connolly's done before. But first, I'm going to describe two ways of doing this calculation before going ahead with a slightly simpler format. So, the basic idea of equilibrium of an entire tensegrity, a very nice way of writing the equilibrium equations, is on the board here. It's writing everything using this thing called the large stress matrix, which I think of in the following way. So I'll describe this matrix in a moment, this matrix S. But the matrix S is a matrix that relates the configuration of the structure. So the configuration of the structure I've written as a vector here, P. And P is, I've just piled on top of each other all of the position vectors of each of the nodes of the structure. And very often, tensegrities are considered to be unloaded externally. So people might write this matrix S times P is equal to zero. But slightly more generally, and I find this helpful to think about, that if you've got some kind of set of self-balanced forces applied at the nodes, where each node you've got a set of forces F1, F2, node 2, etc., all the way through to the last force, then the relationship between the position of the nodes and the forces applied is given by, this is really an equilibrium relationship, and that matrix S has got this very simple form that it's the small stress matrix crossed with the number of dimensions you're working with, and the equilibrium equation for the stress matrix, it simply says that the numbers on the diagonal are simply these what are often called stresses, but I want to call force densities in the members. So this is the force carried by the member divided by the length. And you simply take each node and you sum up the force densities of that node for every member attached to that node. Yeah. Right. So I have. This is always a source of difficulty between different communities. So what is typically called a stress within the rigidity theorist community is a completely different thing to a stress that is used in all of the physical sciences. So I don't want to use the word stress to mean what commonly is thought of as a stress. So I'm happy with the idea of a self-stress. So this is what you would call a stress, I think, but I'm going to call it a force density. So it's the force carried by the member divided by the length of the member. So that's why I use the word density, and that's how it's used in the engineering literature. So I've got a set of force densities at each node. I simply sum them up as being the number along the diagonal, and I have the everywhere there's a cross term where two nodes are connected by a member, I have the minus of the force density at that point. And this essentially then, when I multiply that by a configuration, gives me a set of equilibrium equations at each of the nodes. And this matrix is often called the force density matrix in engineering.
So the force at the node is the omega ij times
the length? Exactly right. Yeah. So what you're adding up is the force times the length, and you're saying the summation of the forces times the length. So the summation of the force densities times the length, i.e. the summation of the forces, is what's got to balance and become equal to zero, or, more generally, be equal to the force that you apply.
Are you allowing the external force?
So I am allowing an external force.
What
although in practice what I'm going to do in a moment is simply say that's equal to zero. But knowing that the right-hand side of the equation is an external force allows you to think about how you can do the symmetry decomposition in a sensible way. So that's why I like to know that it's there, even though I set it to zero. Okay, so I'm now going to transfer over to try and do some things with the chalkboard to describe the general method. Oh, some light. Okay, so I hope everyone's written down these codes, otherwise they'll have to turn up again later. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is describe a recipe for how to generate symmetric tensegrities in a more general way than that will include the examples I've shown around. So that's my plan. And my first step in what you're going to choose is that you choose the symmetry group that you want to work with. Which I'll call G. Now, when I say a symmetry group, what I mean is a set of isometries of space that form a group. So this is different to, so this is a perennial discussion that I have with Bob Connolly, who Bob would always like to work with the slightly more abstract set of permutation groups, which of course are all isomorphic to the symmetry groups. Whereas I actually want to say I want to have a particular type of symmetry. Well, Bob prefers to let that emerge during the calculation. That's right. This is my recipe, not Bob's. But it's so first thing you do is you choose your symmetry group. The second thing you have to do is you have to choose one or more orbits of nodes. So you have to decide how many types of nodes do I want. You might say I simply want one type of node, two different types of nodes, and something else you have to choose is you have to choose the orbit structure. For each of those orbits of nodes that you have. So you can't simply say I want a number of orbits of nodes. You also have to say for each of those orbits, under which symmetry operations might that orbit of nodes be unshifted, by unmoved. So in the example that have gone round, for instance, the Grunbaum example, I'll come back to that later. One of them has two regular orbits of nodes. The other one has one regular orbit and one non-regular orbit. That means if you have a non-regular orbit, the nodes are fixed by certain symmetry operations. And you have to choose that in advance. You can't let that emerge. There has to be a choice that you make, and each choice you make will give you a different tensegrity. And then finally, you have to choose And in this case, you have to have at least two orbits of members. What's a member? A bar or a strut or a cable. And you don't have to choose in advance whether they are... But I'm thinking here they'll be struts or cables because they'll always be tensed. So you have. So essentially what you do is you say, I'm working in a particular symmetry, I have a number of orbits of nodes, and I am going to connect those orbits together in some fashion. And as soon as you've... Those are the choices you have to make. And the question that we're then now going to answer is, once you've made those choices, how do you then generate a tensegrity? And how do you see if actually the tensegrity you've generated is actually a proper stable structure rather than being something that might be unstable? So there's a question of one, finding an equilibrium structure, and two, making sure that even for small perturbations, the structure doesn't collapse rather than stay as a stable structure. So that's the recipe, and there are two ways of going about generating the structure once you've done this, of which one is a somewhat brute force, not very elegant way that was what I was doing, and we could also do it in a slightly more elegant way that I'll do on the board for the Grunbaum example that I passed around. So let's just go back. Okay, go back to this equation. So I call this a brute force method. It's not actually that difficult. It's not that it requires a great deal of computation. But the basic method that you can follow, or one way of following it, is once you've made the three choices above there, you can write down S. In terms of unknown force densities, which I'll call omega I, for each orbit of members I. So because I've already described with my choices exactly what's connected to what, and well, that's it. Once I've got what's connected to what, and I've chosen my force densities, then I can write down the stress matrix. The trouble is, I don't know what force densities I should choose to allow me to get equilibrium. So the question is, how can I make sure that the matrix S has got a large enough nullity that there are solutions to the equation S times P equals zero, i.e. there are configurations that are, let's say I'm working three dimensions, three-dimensional configurations that exist which must lie in the null space of that matrix S. So the question becomes, how do I find these force density? And because this matrix S might be quite a large matrix, depending on the size of nodes, very hard to do that in any kind of analytical sense. So what you can do using symmetry is you can change the coordinate system. And the way I'll change the coordinate system is instead of writing the configuration P and the force F in this rather natural form, I'll write P and F in a way that is written in terms of a number of components, each of which is invariant with respect to all of the symmetry operations. So it's straightforward to write down a new coordinate system, and let's say I've got it in terms of a transformation matrix T in terms of the old. So this is just going to be an orthogonal transformation that turns the original coordinate system into this little tilde, for me, means symmetry adapted. This one is simply written as a set of components, each of which is invariant with respect to all the symmetry operations, and that means that the relationship between the forces applied and the configuration must be written into separate invariant components. So it splits the big structure down into small symmetry adapted calculations, each of which you can do one at a time. So I do that for P, and I do it for the forces as well. And hence, I can write a new matrix, symmetry adapted symmetry stress matrix, which is just going to be TS T to the minus 1. Okay, so that will work, and what you will discover is you have this block diagonal form for the structure. The symmetry matrix, this stress matrix S, will not be full of members anymore. It can be written in terms of a number of blocks, and you can look at each of those blocks and try and work out which of those blocks I can make rank deficient, how I can get some nullity. That'll generate the structure. So that's, yeah. So the S that you generated in the first place has to be a matrix that is invariant with respect to all of the symmetry operations of the group. Because that was how you generated it. I chose a set of symmetric members that are connecting nodes. So I know that I've got that structure there already. It's guaranteed that that's built in. And all I'm doing is writing it in a kind of better way that's invariant with the spectral operations.
Does the orthogonal matrix T depend only on G or on G and the orbits as well?
Good point. So I haven't, because I'm not going to really go down this line, I haven't really got into any detail about this. But yes. This T will depend on the orbit structure and the symmetry, because certain members will transform into other members in different ways to how other members might under symmetry operations. So I'm deliberately not going into this because this is not... Right, it's all correct, but it's not terribly elegant. And we can do it... Essentially what we want to do is to go straight into the relevant bits of this rather than generate everything. And that's the point of what I'm going to show in a moment. So that's what I want to do next. Okay, so... So this is a kind of brute force approach. This works, and indeed counting the size of the various blocks that we have here is exactly what Patrick Fowler is going to talk about in a moment, and that can give you great insight. So you can do lots of calculations on this without actually generating all the members, but if you wanted to actually generate the tensegrity, then you'd have to do the whole calculation. And what I'm going to do now is to avoid doing that by writing down a rather simpler form. And so the more elegant scheme is to go back to the original structure and to realise that this equilibrium equation I have on the board is essentially just an equilibrium equation at each type of node, each orbit of node, and then all of the other members of an orbit have got exactly the same equation written down. So all I need to do is to look at the equilibrium of one orbit, of one member of each orbit, and that ought to be enough to be able to calculate everything I need to do. So that's what I'm going to do now. So, so a more elegant method is to write down an equilibrium equation at, but all I need to do is to choose one representative member. One representative node from each orbit. And the way I'm going to, let's see how I do for time. The way I'm going to do this, and I know mathematicians typically hate this, but it's the way engineers tend to think, is I'm going to just simply take the example that I passed around of the symmetry of the structure, the Grunbaum tensegrity, and I'm going to show how we can simply generate what the equations must be for the force densities that are carried within the members to allow us to get an equilibrium configuration. So, so one thing to notice about that tensegrity that went round, I'll write that here, is it had a symmetry group that I'm going to call S4. This is the standard notation used in the sort of chemical physical sciences for the symmetry group. And the operations that generate the symmetry of that structure are it's actually simply a cyclic group. There is a single generator, which is a quarter turn in proper rotation. So you rotate the structure by 90 degrees and you reflect it through itself. And that's, that operation is also called S4, potentially confusing, but that's how it is. And the operations are, if I do two of those, we start off with the identity E, I've got S4 squared, which is actually simply a twofold rotation, and S4 cubed, which is the inverse operation, rotation in the opposite direction. So that's all of the symmetry operations I have for the structure. So if I was going to generate a structure of this type, I'd say I have to choose the symmetry group. And I must admit, before seeing this example, I wouldn't have thought that there would have been an interest in tensegrity from this symmetry group, because it's such a simple case. But nonetheless there is. I have to choose orbits of nodes, and in this case I'm going to choose that there are two orbits of nodes and that each of those orbits are regular orbits, so they're in general configurations. So here is a picture of the tensegrity. And maybe I'll use two colours. So I've got a yellow node and a white node. And the fact that I've, those are my representative examples of the nodes, but I've got the four symmetry operations means that each of these, because they're regular orbits, will generate three other copies. So if I do a, if I take a positive rotation as being in that direction, then this node will give me let's get this right. So that's one orbit of yellow nodes, and I've also got an orbit of white nodes. And so let's try a different colour. I like green any better? Not much better. Yeah. Okay, let me put a cross in. I think I'll stick with that scheme. Okay, then you have to choose a scheme for connecting together the nodes. And my scheme, so I'm just going to follow the example that I know works, but it would be easy to generalize this to work to all possible schemes that might work. I'm going to have one member which connects these two. So these two nodes here are my kind of representative elements. I'll label them with an E of the structure. And I'm connecting those together. And because I've connected together here, I have to connect it together. Oops. Everywhere else. And I have to choose that I'm going to have, I'm going to call it omega H. H because it turns out that to be horizontal. I could just number them, of course, but this is going to give some sense to the structure I actually end up with. I'm going to choose what the force density is in that, and I have to find out what that's going to be later on. And I'm also going to connect my initial node for the crossed variety of nodes to the... This is the another example that is generated from the identity node by an S4 operation, and that's going to give me another, we'll call that like this, another orbit of nodes that I'll call the vertical nodes. Now they're all connected. Now it would quickly turn out to be to see that that would not give us, if we try to generate the equilibrium equation, we wouldn't be able to get any rank deficiency from our equilibrium from these two, so we need some extra nodes, and the extra nodes we've got are, we've got some I'm going to call this omega S. So that's a single orbit of what I actually end up to be struts of the structure. And finally, as always, as dotted lines, there are members that go across the top and the bottom, and I'll call those the the diagonal to omega g. So I've got four variables here, and I need to find out what are the possible values of the four variables, omega h, omega v, omega s, and omega d, that actually allow you to generate a structure. And all I have to do is to write down the equilibrium equation at example nodes. And the equilibrium equation, I just follow the standard scheme for the stress matrix that we see here. So I'm going to write down here a little 2x2 matrix. Now, why 2x2? Because I've got two types of nodes. That's all. So the first equation will be equilibrium at node, the cross nodes. And the second will be equilibrium of the non-cross nodes. And I'm just going to use the standard scheme here. But I have to allow that I may be connected to a node that is a symmetry operation away from where I started. So I might have, for instance, so let's just simply go through the nodes I've got connected to the top central cross node there. What have I got? I've got an omega H, and I'm going to now, I could simply write, what's the best way to write? No, I'm going to write this down, omega h times a representation matrix of the identity. Now, that's just an identity matrix. So that's simply saying I've got this node is staying in the same place. And I do that for each of the members connected to that central cross node. So I've got omega h times re plus omega v plus omega h omega v omega d or omega s. Make this a little bit bigger. And then I have to write down, I have to take away the symmetry coefficient, the force density that's connected to all the other nodes at the other end of the bars. So what's at the other end of each of the bars that I've got there? Well, I've got one bar, omega d, the one that goes from top to bottom, which is actually connected to another crossed node, but it's connected to another crossed node that has undergone a C2 symmetry operation. So I'm going to take away omega d times a matrix that represents that C2 operation. So everything that's in this first column of the matrix is also all to do with the cross nodes. So the first row and the first column is the cross nodes, whereas all of the other terms go to, not to a cross node, but one of the circle nodes. So that's how the members provide a correspondence between the two different orbits of structures. So let me do a little dotted line here. In the top right, I'm going to take away each of the members that is connected to one of the circle nodes. So I've got omega h connected to the identity there. I've got omega v, which is connected to the identity that's undergone an S4 operation. So you see omega v is connected to the S4 node, not the identity node. And I've also got the omega s, is connected to this one, which is actually S4 to the minus 1. So this is all written down at the moment. So there's two of the equations. I should also write down two more, but I think I'm going to run out of time, so maybe I won't write down the other two equations that I would write down, the other equations I'd write down at the circle node. But the key point that what we can do is exactly what are these matrices RE and RC2 and RS. They describe the transformation of coordinates of the structure. And this is where we can make use of the representation theory to say, well, we know that the simplest way of writing these down would be in terms of a set of irreducible representations of the group. What are the simplest ways of writing down the group? And so it turns out, for instance, for S4, that I could write down all of these matrices in terms of four different possible columns, all of which are one-dimensional. So these are irreducible representations, and basically these matrices RE have either got to be made of a column of ones, or this representation that does 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, or I can have, I have to work in the complex numbers, I minus 1 minus I and 1 minus I minus 1 I. What that tells us is that if I simply take each of those representations one at a time and fill them in with my matrix that I've got here, I will get a set of equations, each of which is a rather straightforward equation to solve, because I'm just going to get a little 2x2 matrix. And it turns out that if, for instance, you look at this A2, the A2 in some way represents the Z coordinate of the structure, and tables will tell you that the Z coordinate of the structure there it is. So, for instance, if I write down this matrix and substitute the values for the representations that I've got here directly from the table, then the A2 case, for instance, will tell me that the omega v has got to be exactly opposite and equal to omega s. Everything else turns out to cancel completely. And I also get an equation relating omega d and omega h that simply says omega h has got to be 2 divided by omega d. So what I get from this is, by simply writing down one 2x2 matrix, because I've got two orbits of nodes, and then substituting in the representation theory that I know must be the simplest possible way of discussing the representation, the coordinates of the group, then that directly gives me the block structure that I need that I generated earlier by saying I can do it in this this rather more brute force approach. So this becomes then a calculation that you can simply straightforwardly do by hand. And if I had a few more minutes, I'd be able to work through this and show you exactly the three 2x2 matrices you could get, and you could get the nullity you require to give a configuration for the structure, and you can check that the matrices are positive semi-definite, and so you can check the structure is also stable. Okay, so I think I'll stop there because I've got over my time a little bit, but thank you.